is the same, he said. Discretion is discretion. It knows no religious bounds.
Is Mrs. Buller hobbler? I asked suddenly.
His brow wrinkled.
A hobbler? Whatever makes you think that? Dear me, that somewhat peculiar faith was, if I am not mistaken, suppressed in the late 18th century. There have been rumours, of course, but one mustn't.
Was it? I interrupted.
Suppressed, I mean.
Could it be that the hobblers had gone underground so effectively that their very presence in Bishop's Lacey was disbelieved by the vicar of St. Tancred's? Whatever her allegiances, the vicar continued, we mustn't pass judgment upon the beliefs of others, must we?
I suppose not, I said, just as the meaning of his earlier words struck home.
Did you say you were talking to a Mr. Sampson? Mr. Sampson of East Finching?
The vicar nodded.
Ted Sampson. He still comes back to lend a hand with the tents and booths. He's been doing it, man and boy, for 25 years. He says it makes him feel close to his parents. They're both of them buried here in the churchyard, you understand. Of course, he's lived in East Finching since he married her.
Yes, I said.
If I'd had whiskers, they'd have been trembling. Oh, dear, the vicar said. I fear I've said too much. You must excuse me. He dropped to his knees and resumed his snipping at the grass, and I knew that our interview was at an end. Gladys's tyres purred on the tarmac as we sped north towards East Finching. It was easy going at first, but then as the road rose up, fold upon fold, into the encircling hills, I had to lean on her pedals like Billy Ho. By the time I reached Pauper's Well at the top of Denham Rise, I was panting like a dog. I dismounted and, leaning Gladys against the stone casing of the well, dropped to my knees for a drink. Pauper's Well was not so much a well as a natural spring, a place where the water gurgled up from some underground source and had done so since before the Romans had helped themselves to an icy, refreshing swig. Spring water, I knew, was a remarkable chemical soup. Calcium, magnesium, potassium, iron, and assorted salts and sulfates. I grabbed the battered old tin cup that hung from a chain, scooped it full of the burbling water, and drank until I thought I could feel my bones strengthening. With the water still dribbling down my chin, I stood up and looked out over the countryside. Behind me, spread out like a handkerchief for a doll's picnic, was Bishop's Lacey. Through it, this side of the high street, the River Effen wound its lazy way round the village before ambling off to the southwest and Buckshaw. Now, almost 2 weeks into the harvest, most of the countryside had traded its intense summer green for a paler greyish shade, as if Mother Nature had nodded off a little and let the colours leak away. In the distance, like a black bug crawling up the hillside, a tractor dragged a harrow across a farmer's field, the buzz of its engine coming clearly to my ears. From up here, I could see the Parlings to the south, a green oasis at a bend in the river. And there was Buckshaw, its stones glowing warmly in the sunlight, as if they had been cut from precious citrine and polished by a master's hand. Harriet's house, I thought, although for the life of me I don't know why. Something was welling up in my throat. It must have been something in the well water. I took Gladys from her resting place and shoved off towards East Finching. From this point on, the journey was all downhill. After a couple of jolly good pumps to get up speed, I put my feet up on the handlebars, and Gladys and I, with the wind in our teeth, came swooping like a harrier down the dusty road into East Finching's High Street. Unlike its neighbours, Malden Fenwick and Bishop's Lacey, East Finching was not a pretty bit of ye old England. No half-timbered houses here, no riot of flowers and cottage gardens. Instead, the word that came to mind was grubby. At least half the shops in the High Street had boarded up windows, while those that were apparently still in business had rather a sad and defeated look. In the window of a tobacconist's shop on the corner, a crooked sign advertised today's papers. A bell above the door gave out a harsh jangle as I stepped inside, and a grey-haired man with old-fashioned square spectacles looked up from his newspaper.
"Well," he said, as if I had surprised him in his bath.
"Excuse me," I said. "I wonder if you can help me. I'm looking for Mr. Sampson, Edward Sampson. Could you tell me where he lives?"
"What you want with him, then? Selling biscuits, are you?"
His mouth broke into a ghastly grin, revealing three horrid teeth which appeared to be carved from rotted wood. It was the same thing, more or less, that the abominable Ursula had said to me at Vanetta Harewood's door. A bad joke that was doing the rounds of the countryside, the way bad jokes do. I held my tongue.
"Selling biscuits, are you?"
he said again, like a music hall comic beating a joke to death. "Actually, no," I said. "Mr. Sampson's parents are buried in St. Tancred's churchyard in Bishop's Lacey, and we're setting up a graves maintenance fund. It's the war, you see. We thought that perhaps he'd like to..." The man stared at me sceptically over his spectacles. I was going to have to do better than this.
"Oh, yes, I almost forgot. I also bring thanks from the vicar and the ladies of the Women's Institute and the Altar Guild for Mr. Sampson's help with the fete on Saturday. It was a smashing success."
"I think it was the WI and the Altar Guild that did it." The tobacconist wrinkled his nose in disgust, hitched his spectacles a little higher, and jabbed his thumb towards the street.
"Yellow fence," he said, "salvage,"
and went back to his reading.
"Thank you," I said.
"You're very kind."
And I almost meant it.
The place was hard to miss. A tall wooden fence in a shade of yellow that betrayed the use of war's surplus aviation paint sagged inwards and outwards along three sides of a large property. It was evident that the fence had been thrown up in an attempt to hide from the street the ugliness of the salvage business, but with little effect. Behind its boards, piles of rusting metal scrap towered into the air like heaps of giant jackstraws. On the fence, tall red letters, painted by an obviously amateur hand, spelled out, "Sampson, salvage, scrap iron bought, best prices, motor parts." An iron rod leant against the double gates, holding them shut. I put my eye to the crack and peered inside. Maddeningly, there wasn't much to see. Because of the angle, my view was blocked by a wrecked lorry that had been overturned and its wheels removed. With a quick glance up and down the street, I shifted the rod, tugged the gates open a bit, took a deep breath, and squeezed through. Immediately in front of me, a sign painted in blood-red letters on the hulk of a pantechnicon said, "Beware of the dock," as if the animal in question had gone for the artist's throat before he could finish the letter G. I stopped in my tracks and listened, but there was no sign of the beast. Perhaps the warning was meant simply to scare off strangers. On one side of the yard was a good-sized Nissen hut which, judging by the tire tracks leading to its double doors, was in regular use. To my right, like a row of iron oast-houses, the towering junk piles I had seen from outside the gates led away towards the back of the lot. Projecting from the closest heap, as if it had just crashed and embedded itself, was what surely must be the back half of a Spitfire. The red, white and blue RAF markings as fresh and bright as if they had been applied just yesterday. The fence had concealed the size of the place. It must have covered a couple of acres. Beyond the mountains of scrap, spotted here and there, scores of wrecked motor cars subsided sadly into the grass, and even at the back of the property, where the scrap gave way gradually to an orchard, blotches of coloured metal glinting among the trees signalled that there were bodies there too. As I moved warily along the gravel path between the heaps of broken machinery, hidden things gave off an occasional rusty ping, as if they were trying to warm themselves enough in the sun to come back to life, but with little success. "Hello," I called, hoping desperately that there would be no answer, and there wasn't. At the end of an L-shaped bend in the gravel was a brick structure, rather like a washhouse, I thought, or perhaps a laundry, with a round chimney rising up about 30 feet above its flat roof. The windows were so coated with grime that even by rubbing with my fist, I could see nothing inside. In place of a knob, the door was furnished with what looked like a homemade latch, something cobbled together from bits of iron fencing. I put my thumb on the tongue of the thing and pressed it down. The latch popped up, the door swung open, and I stepped into the dim interior. The place was unexpectedly bare. On one side was a large fire chamber whose open door revealed a bottom covered with cold ashes and cinders. On its side was mounted what appeared to be a motor-driven blower. These things hadn't changed in 400 or 500 years, I thought. Aside from the electric fan, there was little difference between this device and the crucibles of the alchemists that filled the pages of several vellum manuscripts in Uncle Tar's library. In essence, this furnace was not unlike the gas crucible that Uncle Tar had installed in the laboratory at Buckshaw, but on a much larger scale, of course. On the brick hearth in front of the furnace, beside a long steel ladle, lay several broken moulds, wooden chests that had been filled with sand into which objects had been pressed to make an impression, into which the molten iron had then been poured. Dogs, by the look of them, I thought. Spaniels indented in the sand to make a pair of doorstops. Or fire dogs. And I knew then, even though I had not yet had a chance to test them for authenticity, that it was here, in Edward Sampson's washhouse foundry, that copies of Sally Fox and Shoppo had been cast, the copies that were likely, at this very moment, standing in for the originals on the drawing-room hearth at Buckshaw. But where were Harriet's originals? Were they the fire irons I had seen in Miss Mountjoy's coach house, the antiques warehouse in which Brookie Harewood kept his treasure? Or were they the ones I had seen in the hands of Sampson, the bulldog man, at the back door of Pettibone's antique shop? I shuddered at the very thought of it. Still, I had already accomplished much of what I had come to do. All that remained was to search the Nissen hut for papers. With any luck, a familiar name might well pop up. At that moment, I heard the sound of a motor outside. I glanced quickly round the room. Save for diving into the cold furnace, there was nowhere to hide. The only alternative was to dash out into the open and make a run for it. I chose the furnace. Thoughts of Hansel and Gretel crossed my mind as I pulled the heavy door shut behind me and crouched, trying to make myself as small as possible. Another dress ruined, I thought, and another sad-eyed lecture from Father. It was then that I heard the footsteps on the stone floor. I hardly dared take a breath. The sound of it would be amplified grotesquely by the brick beehive in which I was huddled. The footsteps paused, as if the person outside were listening. They moved on, then stopped again. There was a metallic clang as something touched the door just inches from my face. And then, slowly, so slowly that I nearly screamed from suspense, the door swung open. The first thing I saw was his boots. Large, dusty, scarred from work. Then the leg of his coveralls. I raised my eyes and looked into his face. Dieter! It was Dieter Schrantz, the labourer from Culverhouse Farm, Bishop Lacey's sole remaining prisoner of war, who had elected to stay in England after the end of hostilities. Is it really you? I began dusting myself off as I scrambled out of the furnace. Even when I had come out of my crouch and stood up straight, Dieter still towered above me, his blue eyes and blonde hair making him seem like nothing so much as a vastly overgrown schoolboy. "What are you doing here?" I asked, breaking out in a silly grin. Am I permitted to ask the same? Dieter said, taking in the whole room with a sweep of his hand. Unless this place has become part of Buckshaw, I should say you're a long way from home.
I smiled politely at his little joke. Dieter had something of a crush on my sister Feely, but aside from that, he was a decent enough chap.
I was playing solitaire, hare and hounds, I said, making up rules wildly and talking too fast. East Finching counts double for a compound name, and Sampson's scores a triple S. Sampson's, Salvage, and Scrap, see? I get an extra point for having someone with a biblical name, but today's not a Sunday, so it doesn't count.
Dieter nodded gravely.
Very complex, the English rules, he said. I have never completely grasped them myself.
He moved towards the door, but turned to see if I was following.
Come on, he said. I'm going your way. I'll give you a lift.
I wasn't particularly ready to leave, but I knew that my nosing around was at an end. Who, after all, can carry out full-scale snoopage with a six-foot-something ex-prisoner of war dogging one's every footstep?
I blinked a bit as we stepped out into the sun.
On the far side of the path, Dieter's old grey Ferguson tractor stood tut-tutting to itself, like an elephant that has stumbled by accident upon the elephant's graveyard, a little shocked, perhaps, to find itself suddenly among the bones of its ancestors. After closing the gate, I climbed onto the hitch between the two rear wheels and dragged Gladys up behind me. Dieter let in the clutch and we were off, the Fergie's tall tires sending up a spray of cinders that fell away behind us like dark fireworks. We flew like the wind, basking in the September sunlight and drinking in the fresh autumn air. So it was only when we were halfway down the south slope of Denham Rise that the penny dropped. My posterior was braced firmly against one of the Fergie's wings and my feet on the clanking hitch. As we sped along, the ground beneath was just a rushing blur of greenish black.
But why, I thought suddenly, would a farmer be so far from home with no trailer rumbling along behind, no plough, no harrow swaying in the rear? It simply made no sense. I felt my hackles beginning to rise.
Who sent you? I shouted above the whistling wind and the roar of the Fergie's engine.
What?
I knew from my own experience that he was stalling for time.
What? He said again, as if I hadn't heard him, which made me suddenly and inexplicably furious.
It was father, wasn't it?
But even as the words came out of my mouth, I knew that I was wrong. There was no more chance that father would telephone Dieter than that the man in the moon should ring up the rat catcher.
Inspector Hewitt?
I was clutching at straws. The inspector was equipped with his own official transportation and would never send a civilian on one of his errands. Dieter shoved up the throttle in its quadrant and the tractor slowed. He pulled off into a small lay-by where a wooden platform was piled with milk containers. He turned to me, not smiling.
It was Ophelia, he said.
Feely! I screeched. Had my sister sent Dieter to follow me? All day? How dare she? How doubly damned dare she? This was an outrage. That I should be thwarted, torn away, kidnapped, virtually, from an important investigation by my own sister made me see red. Bright red. Without a word, I jumped down from the tractor's hitch, lifted Gladys onto the road, and set off walking down the hill, my head held high and my pigtails swaying. When I got far enough away to remember it, I put one foot onto a pedal and mounted, shoving off shakily, but recovering enough to begin an offended but dignified coasting. Moments later, I heard the tractor's engine rev up, but I did not look back. Dieter pulled alongside, driving precisely to keep pace.
She was worried about you, he said.
She wanted me to see that you were all right. Feely, worried about me?
I could hardly believe it. I could count on one finger the times she had treated me decently in the past couple of years. To spy on me, you mean? I shot back.
It was a mean thing to say, but I said it. I quite liked Dieter, but the thought of him being under my sister's thumb made me livid.
Come on, hop up, Dieter said, bringing the tractor to a full stop. Your bicycle, too.
No, thank you very much. We prefer to be alone.
I began pedaling to get ahead of the tractor. I suppose I could have pulled over and waited, then climbed aboard for a graciously accepted ride into the village. But by the time I thought of it, I was already halfway up the high street. I was disappointed not to find Dogger at work in the greenhouse. It was always such a pleasure to slip in, sit quietly down beside him, and fall into easy conversation, like two old gaffers on a bench beside the duck pond. Second choice, when I wanted information, was Mrs. Mullet. But as I discovered when I stepped into the kitchen, she had already gone home for the day. I'd have given anything to be able to pump Daffy about the hobblers, but something kept me from asking any more of her. I still hadn't taken my revenge for her part in the cellar inquisition, even though I had already twice broken my injured silence to ask her about Poseidon and about Hilda Muir, or Hilda Muir, to be more precise, and the pixies. It seemed to me that you couldn't possibly win a war in which you were forever going over to the other side for advice. Also, fraternizing, or whatever you call it when sisters do it, with the enemy, diluted one's resolve to kick them in the teeth. My head was fairly fizzing with information, and there had been little time to sort it all out. Some of the more interesting points had already begun to come together in my mind, clustering and curdling in much the same way that silver chloride, good old AgCl, forms a sort of chemical cheese when a soluble chloride is added to silver nitrate. Soluble. That was the word. Would I ever be able to solve this complex tangle of puzzles? One thing was immediately clear. I needed to know more, much, much more, about the hobblers. And it was clear that no hobbler of my immediate acquaintance was going to make my life easier by spilling the beans. Chapter 21. I awakened to the roar of water on the roof tiles and in the drains, the sound of Buckshaw in the rain. Even before I opened my eyes, I could hear that the whole house had come alive in a way that it never did in dry weather. A deep, wet breathing in and out, as if, after a mad dash down the centuries, the tired old place had just thrown itself across the finish line. There would be little winds in the corridors, I knew, and sudden cold draughts would spring up in out-of-the-way corners. In spite of its size, Buckshaw had all the comfort of a submarine. I wrapped myself in my blanket and stumped to the window. Outside, the stuff was coming straight down, as if it were lines drawn with pencil and a ruler. It was not the kind of rain that was going to pass away quickly. We were in for hours of it. Father acknowledged my presence at the breakfast table with a curt nod. At least he didn't try to make Chip a conversation, I thought, and for that I offered up a little prayer of thanksgiving. Feely and Daffy, as usual, were busily pretending that I didn't exist. Rainy days cast a darker-than-usual pall over our morning meal, and today was no exception. Our September breakfast menu had been in force for almost 2 weeks now, and the base of my tongue shrank back a little as Mrs. Mullet brought to the table what I thought of as our daily ration of T-O-A-D. Toast, oatmeal, apple juice, dates. The dates, stewed and served with cold clotted cream, were another of Mrs. Mullet's culinary atrocities. They looked and tasted like something that had been stolen from a coffin in a midnight churchyard. "Pass the dead man's," Daffy would say, without looking up from her book, and Father would fix her with a flickering glare until the latest philatelic journal dragged his attention back to its pages, a time span of, usually, no more than about 2¾ seconds. But today Daffy said nothing,
her arm reaching out robotically and shoveling a few spoonfuls of the vile mess into a bowl. Feely wasn't down yet, so I made a relatively easy escape.
"May I be excused, please?" I asked, and Father grunted.
Seconds later, I was in the hall closet, fishing out my bright yellow waterproof. "When cycling in the rain," Dogger had told me, "being visible is more important than keeping dry."
"You mean that I can always dry out, but I can't be brought back to life when I'm impaled on the horns of a Daimler?" I said, partly joking.
"Precisely," Dogger had said with a perfect tiny smile, and gone back to waxing Father's boots. It was still coming down like lances as I made a dash for the greenhouse, where I had left Gladys. Gladys didn't much like the rain, since it made her skirts muddy, but she never complained. I had plotted my course to Rook's End with great care, avoiding both the gully and the house of the dreaded Mrs. Bull. As I pedalled along the road towards Bishop's Lacey in my yellow Macintosh, I remembered what Dogger had said about visibility. In spite of the mist that hung like tatters of grey laundry over the soaked fields, I could probably be seen for miles. And yet, in another sense, because I was only 11 years old, I was wrapped in the best cloak of invisibility in the world. I thought of the time Mrs. Mullet had taken me to see the Invisible Man. We had gone on the bus to Hindley to replace an Easter dress that I had ruined, drawing a particularly interesting, but failed, experiment involving both sulfuric and hydrochloric acids. After a sickening hour in Fashions by Eleanor, a shop in the High Street whose windows were bandaged over with paper banners in dreadful shades of pink and aqua, "Latest Easter frocks for young misses, new from London, just in time for Easter," Mrs. Mullet had taken pity on me and suggested a visit to a nearby ABC tea shop. There we had sat for 3/4 of an hour at a table in the window, watching people stroll by on the pavement outside. Mrs. M had become quite chatty and, forgetting perhaps that I wasn't her friend Mrs. Waller, had let slip several things that, although they were not important at the time, would probably come in handy when I was older. After the tea and the pastries, with most of the afternoon still ahead of us, "You was a real trooper about the frock, dear, in spite of them two witches with their tapes and pins," Mrs. M had decided to treat me to the cinema she had spotted in the narrow street beside the tea shop. Because Mrs. Mullet had seen it years before, she talked all the way through The Invisible Man, nudging me in the ribs as she explained it to me minute by minute. "He can see them, like, but they can't see him." Although I was amused at the mad scientist's idea of injecting a powerful bleach to render himself invisible, what truly shocked me was the way he treated his laboratory equipment. "It's just a film, dear," Mrs. Mullet said, as I gripped her arm during the smashing of the glassware. But all in all, I thought, looking back on it, the entertainment had not been a success. Invisibility was nothing new to me. It was an art I had been forced to learn from the day I took my first step. Visible and invisible, the trick of being present and absent at the same time. "Yahoo!" I shouted to no one in particular as I splashed past St. Tancred's and into the High Street. At the far end of the village, I turned south. Through the rain, I could just make out in the distance the jack-o'-lantern, a skull-shaped formation of rock that overhung my destination, Rook's End. I was now running parallel to and a half mile due east of the gully, and before many minutes had passed, I was gliding along the edge of one of the great lawns that stretched off in three directions. I had been at Rook's End once before to visit Father's old schoolmaster, Dr. Kissing. On that occasion, I had found him in the decaying solarium of the nursing home, and was not looking forward to setting foot in that particular mausoleum again today. But much to my surprise, as I leapt off Gladys at the front door, there was the old gentleman himself, sitting in a wheelchair beneath a large, gaily coloured umbrella that had been set up on the lawn.
He waved as I plodded towards him through the wet grass.
"Ha, Flavia," he said. "It can be no ill day which brings a young visitor to my gate. Horace, of course. Or was it Catullus?"
I grinned as if I knew but had forgotten.
"Hello, Dr. Kissing," I said, handing over the packet of players I had filched from Feely's lingerie drawer. Feely had bought the things to impress Dieter, but Dieter had joked her out of it.
"No, thank you," he said when she offered him the packet. "They ruin the chest."
And she had put the cigarettes away unopened.
Feely was uncommonly proud of her chest.
"Ah,"
Dr. Kissing said, producing a box of matches as if from nowhere and striking one expertly as he was still opening the packet of cigarettes.
"How very kind of you to think of my one great weakness."
He inhaled deeply, holding the smoke in his lungs for what seemed like an eternity. Then, letting it escape as he spoke, he gazed off into the distance as if addressing someone else.
"Thus he ruins his health and his substance destroys by vainly pursuing his fanciful joys, till perhaps in the frolic he meets with his bane and runs on the weapon by which he is slain."
"And runs on the weapon by which he was slain?"
My blood chilled as he spoke the last line.
Was he referring to his own smoking of cigarettes, or to the bizarre death of Brookie Harewood? A conversation with Dr. Kissing was, I knew, a game of chess. There would be no shortcuts.
"The Hobblers," I said, making the opening move.
"Ah, yes," he smiled, "the Hobblers. I knew you would ask me about the Hobblers. One should have been disappointed if you hadn't."
Could Mr. or Mrs. Pettibone have told him of my interest? Somehow, it seemed unlikely.
"Surely you don't suspect that I am one of them?"
"No," I said, struggling to keep up with him. "But I knew that your niece..." Until that very moment, I had nearly forgotten that Dr. Kissing was Miss Mountjoy's uncle.
"My niece? You thought that Tilda was keeping me briefed on your..." "Good Lord, no. She tells me nothing, nor anyone else. Not even God himself knows what Tilda's left hand is doing nowadays."
He saw my puzzlement.
"One needs look no farther than one's own hearth," he said.
"Mrs. Mullet?"
Dr. Kissing coughed a wheezy cough, which reminded me, uncomfortably, of Fenella, and consoled himself by lighting another cigarette.
"It is common knowledge that you are situated, as it were, in close proximity to the estimable Mrs. Mullet. The rest is mere conjecture." "One has not, of course," he went on, "communicated personally with the good woman," he said, "but I believe she is known far and wide for,
"Dishing the dirt," I volunteered.
He made a little bow from his waist.
"Your descriptive powers leave me in the dust," he said.
I could easily grow to love this man. "I know about Nicodemus Flitch," I told him, "and how he brought his faith to Bishop's Lacey. I know that there are still a few practicing hobblers in the neighbourhood, and that they still gather occasionally at the Parlings."
"To conduct baptisms?"
"Yes," I said, "for baptisms."
"A much more common practice in years gone by," he said. "There are nowadays few hobblers left of childbearing age."
I tried to think of who they might be.
Certainly not Tilda Mountjoy, or Mrs. Pettibone.
"I believe poor Mrs. Bull was the last," he said, and I noticed he was watching me out of the corner of his eye.
"Mrs. Bull? Was Mrs. Bull a hobbler?" "Mrs. Bull, who lives in the gully?" I asked. "The one whose baby was taken by gypsies?" I couldn't help myself, even though I didn't believe it. The fearful words slipped out before I could think.
Dr. Kissing nodded.
"So it is said."
"But you don't believe it."
I was in fine form now, catching every shade of the old man's meaning.
"I must confess that I don't," he said, "and I expect that you would like me to tell you why."
I could only manage a stupid grin. Although the rain was still beating down upon the umbrella with a monotonous drumming, there was a surprising stillness and a warmth beneath its protective cover. Across the lawn, the dreadful house that was Rook's End crouched like a giant stone toad. In one of its tall windows, in what had once perhaps been the ballroom, two old ladies in outlandish and outdated costumes were dancing a stately minuet. I had seen this pair on my last visit to Dr. Kissing, executing their timeless steps beneath the trees, and now they had obviously spotted me. As I watched, the shorter of the two paused long enough to wave a gloved hand, and the other, seeing her partner's greeting, came almost to the glass and made a deep and elaborate curtsy. By the time I brought my attention back to Dr. Kissing, he was lighting another cigarette.
"Until last year," he said, watching the smoke vanish into the rain, "I was still able to make my way to the top of the jack-o'-lantern. For a young man in tip-top physical condition, it is no more than a pleasant stroll, but for a fossil in a wheelchair, it is torture. But then, to an old man, even torture can be a welcome relief to boredom, so I often made the ascent out of nothing more than spite. From the summit, one can survey the terrain as if from the basket of a hot air balloon. To the northwest, in the distance, is Grayminster School, scene of my greatest triumphs and my greatest failure. To the west, one has a clear view of the Parlings, and behind it, Buckshaw, your ancestral home. It was at the Parlings, incidentally, that I once asked the lovely Letitia Humphrey for her hand in holy matrimony. And it was at the Parlings that Letitia had the jolly good sense to say no.
I'll bet she lived to regret it, I said gallantly.
She lived, but without remorse. Letitia went on to marry a man who made a fortune adulterating wheat flour with bone dust. I am given to understand that they made each other very happy.
A cloud of tobacco smoke made his sigh suddenly visible in the damp air.
"Did you regret it?" I asked. It was not a polite question, but I wanted to know. "Although I scale the jack-o'-lantern no more," he said, "it is not entirely because of my infirmities, but rather because of the increasingly great sadness that is visible from the summit, a sadness which is not nearly so noticeable from the lower altitudes."
"The Parlings?"
"There was a time when I loved to gaze down upon that ancient crook in the river as if from the summit of my years. In fact, I was doing so on that day in April, 2.5 years ago, when the bull baby disappeared."
My mouth must have fallen open.
"From my vantage point, I saw the gypsy leave her encampment, and later saw Mrs. Bull pushing the baby's perambulator along the gully."
"Hold on," I said. "Surely it was the other way round."
"It was, as I have described. The gypsy woman hitched her horse and drove her caravan north along the gully. Sometime later, the bull woman appeared, wheeling her baby south towards the Parlings."
"Perhaps the pram was empty," I ventured.
"An excellent point," Dr. Kissing said, "except for the fact that I saw her lift out the infant whilst she retrieved its lost bottle from the blankets."
"But then Fenella couldn't have kidnapped the baby."
"Very good, Flavia. As you may have perceived, I've long ago come to that same conclusion."
"But
why did I not inform the police?"
I nodded dumbly.
"I have asked myself that again and again, and each time I have answered that it was, in part, because the police never asked me. But that will hardly do, will it?"
There is also the undeniable fact that when one reaches a certain age, one hesitates to take on a new cargo of trouble. It is as if, having experienced a certain amount of grief in a lifetime, one is given a parslip to hand in to the great headmaster in the sky. Do you understand?
I think I do, I said.
That is why I have kept it to myself, he said. But oddly enough, it is also the reason that I am now telling you.
The silence between us was broken only by the sound of the falling rain. Then suddenly, from across the lawn, there came a shout.
Dr. Kissing, whatever are you thinking?
It was the White Phantom, the same nurse I had seen on my previous visit to Rook's End, now looking ludicrous in her white uniform and huge black galoshes as she came galumphing across the grass towards us through the falling rain.
Whatever are you thinking?
She asked again as she stepped beneath the umbrella. I've observed that domineering people like the White Phantom often say everything twice, as though they're on a quota system.
I am thinking, Nurse Hammond, Dr. Kissing said, of the sad decline in English manners since the late war.
His words were met with a silent sniff as she seized the handles of his wheelchair and shoved off rapidly with it across the lawn. As she paused to open the conservatory door, Dr. Kissing's words came floating back to my ears.
Tally-ho, Flavia!
It was a call to the hunt. I waved like mad to show him that I had understood, but it was too late. He had already been wheeled indoors and out of sight. Chapter 22. I think there must be a kind of courage that comes from not being able to make up your mind. Whether it was this, or whether it was Gladys's willfulness, I can't be sure. But there we were, suddenly swerving off the main road and into the gully. I had been going here and there about the village, avoiding the unpleasant Mrs. Bull, in much the same way as a housefly avoids the folded newspaper. But the gully was a short cut home to Buckshaw, and there was no time like the present. Although Gladys's black paint was now spattered with mud, she seemed as frisky as if she had just been curried with a bristle brush and wiped down to perfection. Her nickel handlebars, at least, glittered in the sun.
"You're enjoying this, aren't you, old girl?" I said,
and she gave a little squeak of delight. Would Mrs. Bull be standing guard at her gate? Would I have to pretend again to be Margaret Vole, niece of that fictional, but beloved, old character actress Gilda Dickinson? I needn't have worried. Mrs. Bull was nowhere in sight, although the hovering smoke from the rubbish heaps made it difficult to see much of the property. Her red-headed boy, the one who had been perched in the branches when I rode through the gully with Fenella, was now sitting in the ditch at the edge of the road, digging his way to China with a piece of cutlery. I brought Gladys to a slithering stop and put both feet on the ground.
"Hello," I said, rather stupidly. "What's your name?"
It was not the most brilliant opening, but I wasn't accustomed to talking to children and hadn't the faintest idea how to begin. It didn't matter anyway, because the little wretch ignored me and went on with his excavating. It was difficult to judge his age, which might have been anywhere between 4 and 7. His large head wobbled uneasily atop a spindly body, giving the impression that one was looking at rather a large baby or a small adult.
"Timothy," he said in a froggy croak, just as I was about to shove off.
"Timothy?" There was another awkward pause, during which I shifted uneasily from foot to foot.
"Timothy,
is your mother at home, Timothy?" I asked.
"Dunno, yes, no,"
he said, giving me a wary sideways glance, and he returned to his digging, stabbing fiercely at the soil with his bit of tableware.
"Digging for treasure, are you?"
I asked, going all chummy.
I leaned Gladys against the bank and climbed down into the ditch. Here, let me help. I casually worked my hand into my offside pocket and closed my fingers around a stick of horehound. With a quick darting motion, I reached down into the hole he was digging and pretended to extract the sweet. "Oh, Timothy," I cried, clapping my hands. "Look what you found. Good boy. Timothy's found a sweet." Although it jarred, I couldn't bring myself to call him by any name other than the one he had called himself. As I held out the horehound, he snatched it away from me with a lightning-fast movement and shoved it into his mouth.
"Treasure,"
he said, gnawing nastily.
"Yes, treasure," I cooed. "Timothy's found buried treasure."
With the horehound stick jutting out of the corner of his mouth like a sick room thermometer, Timothy put down his digging implement and attacked the hole with his bare hands. My heart gave a leap as my mind registered what now lay exposed in the dirt. The silver, the prongs, the figure of the lobster punched from the handle, the Deluce monogram. The child was digging with one of the Deluce lobster picks. But how could that be? Dogger had already shipped the silver to Sotheby's for auction, and the only piece that had been overlooked, perhaps, was the one that had been used to put paid to Brookie Harewood. And that, unless I was sadly mistaken, had, until quite recently, been shoved up Brookie Harewood's nostril and into his brain. How could it possibly have made its way from there into the hands of an urchin grubbing in the gully? Or could this be a copy? "Here," I said, "let me help you. I'm bigger. I can dig faster. Find more sweets." I made digging motions with my hands, scooping like a badger. But Timothy snatched up the lobster pick and was holding it away from me.
"Mime," he said around the horehound. "Mime, Timothy found it."
"Good boy," I said. "Let's have a look."
"No."
"All right," I said. "I don't want to see it anyway." If there's anyone on earth who knows the way of a child's mind, I thought, it's me, Flavia Deluce, for I had not so long ago been one myself. As I spoke, I reached into my pocket and extracted another stick of horehound, this one my last. I gazed at it fondly, held it up to the sunlight to admire its golden glow, smacked my lips.
"Give over," the child said. "I want it."
"Tell you what," I told him. "I'll trade you for that nasty digger. You don't want that old thing. It's dirty." I pulled a horrid face and went through the motions of retching, sound effects and all. He grinned and inserted the prongs of the lobster pick into one of his nostrils. "No, Timothy," I said in the most commanding voice I could summon. "It's sharp. You'll hurt yourself. Give it here." "At once," I added sternly, putting on the voice of authority, as father does when he wants to be instantly obeyed. I held out my hand, and Timothy meekly laid the silver lobster pick across my lifeline. The very part of my hand that the gypsy, Fenella, was it only 3 days ago, had held in her own and told me that in it she saw darkness. "Good boy," I said, my head swimming as my fingers closed upon the murder weapon. "Where did you get it?" I handed him the horehound stick, and he grabbed it greedily. I shoved my hand into my empty pocket as if I were digging into a bottomless bag of sweets. I locked my eyes with his, noticing, for the first time, the strange transparency of his irises. I would not look away, I thought, not until...
"Danny's market,"
he said suddenly, his words oozing out around the sticky horehound.
"Danny's market?"
"Danny's pocket, of course." I was proud of myself. But who is Danny? It couldn't be the baby. The baby wasn't old enough to have pockets. Did Mrs. Bull have an older son? My mind was buzzing with possibilities as I shoved the lobster fork into my pocket. It was a mistake.
"Ma'am!"
the child shrieked.
"Ma'am! Ma'am! Ma'am! Ma'am!"
each cry louder and higher in pitch. I scrambled out of the ditch and made for Gladys. "Ma'am! Ma'am! Ma'am! Ma'am!"
The little rotter had been set off like a blasted alarm.
"You!" came a voice from out of the smoke, and suddenly Mrs. Bull was coming towards me, lumbering through the smouldering heaps like something out of a nightmare.
"You!" she shouted, her raw arms already extended, ready to seize me.
Once she laid hands on me, I knew I was done for. The woman was big enough to tear me apart like a bundle of rotten rags.
I grabbed at Gladys and pushed off, my feet slipping wildly from the pedals as I threw myself forward, trying to put on speed. Oddly enough, I was thinking quite clearly. Should I try to divert her by shouting fire and pointing at her house? Since the place was surrounded by smouldering rubbish heaps, it seemed both a good and a bad idea. But it was no time for tactics. Mrs. Ball was bearing down upon me with alarming speed.
"Ma'am! Ma'am! 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 Ma'am!"
Timothy went on maddeningly from the ditch. The woman's huge hand snatched at me as our paths intersected. I needed to get past her to be safe. If she managed to seize even so much as one of my sleeves, I was sunk.
"Yaroo!"
The cry came out of me quite unexpectedly, but I recognized it at once. It was the battle cry of a savage, a fierce, fearless bellowing that rose up out of my ancestral lungs as if it had been lying in wait for centuries.
"Yaroo!"
I let another fly just for pleasure. It felt good. Mrs. Bull didn't stop, but she faltered, missed a step, and I shot past. I looked back over my shoulder and saw the woman standing in the road, her fist shaking, her red face contorted with fury as she screamed,
"Tom, get yourself out here and bring the axe."
I sat on the river's edge, letting the water cool my feet. There was an unearthly silence in the Parlings, and I shivered a little at the thought of the things that had happened within the past few days. First, there had been the attack on Fenella, followed almost immediately by the death of Brookie Harewood. Then, too, Porcelain had told me, just before she cleared off, that the police had found the body of a baby, probably the Bulls' baby, right here in the grove. I suppose I should have felt sorry for the mother. She may have been mad with grief for all I knew. Perhaps I should have taken my life in my hands and expressed my condolences. But life is never easy, is it? If only one could make time run backwards, as it does in those short subjects at the cinema, where dynamited factory chimneys fall upwards and restore themselves, and shattered bits of glass fly together to form a vase. In such a world I could, if I wished, bicycle backwards up the gully, dismount from Gladys, and give the woman a hug. I could tell her I was sorry they'd found the body of her baby buried here in the Parlings, and that if there was anything I could do to help, she had only to ask. I sighed. Across the river and through the trees, not far from where Fenella's caravan was parked, I could see a mound of fresh soil. That must be the spot where the body had been found. Other than the fact that she'd seen the baby's foot. "Wrapped in a carpet or something," she had said. "A bundle of old green bones." Porcelain hadn't given me any more of the details. And it was too late now. Porcelain was gone. I could hardly ask Inspector Hewitt about the discovery of the body, and until I had the opportunity to find out from Mrs. Mullet what the village was saying, I was on my own. I would wade across and have a look. The river was not very deep here. The Hobblers, after all, had been coming to this spot for centuries to baptize their babies. The water was of just sufficient depth for a good old ducking, and I was no more than 100 feet from the disturbed spot where the police had evidently made their gruesome find. I hitched up the hem of my dress a couple of inches and started across. Even a few feet out from the bank, the water grew noticeably colder on the bottom as I waded slowly towards the centre, my arms wide spread for balance, taking great care not to lose my footing in the ever-strengthening current. Soon I was at the halfway point, and then I was past it. The water level had receded to just below my knees when I stepped on something hard, stumbled, missed my footing, and went flailing tail over tea kettle into the water. Total immersion. "Oh, rat spit," I said. I was furious with myself. Why hadn't I taken Gladys and walked her across the little bridge? Double rat spit. I scrambled to my feet and looked down at myself. My dress was completely soaked. Father would be furious.
"Damn it all. Dash it all, Flavia," he would say, as he always did, and then would begin one of those silences between us that would last for several days until one of us forgot about my offence.
"Being at loggerheads," Daffy called it, and now, as I stood knee-deep in the water, I tried to imagine that I had been suddenly transported to a cold, rushing river somewhere in the Canadian North Woods, with the severed heads of the loggers bobbing past me in the current like bloated, grizzled apples. But practicality brought me back to Bishop's Lacey. I knew that when I got home to Buckshaw, I would have to sneak into the house, make my way upstairs, and rinse out the dress in the sink of my laboratory. In the water, the little cloud of mud stirred up by my feet was clearing quickly. It was odd. Although I could easily see the tops of my feet on the river's bed, there were no stones in sight. And yet I had certainly tripped on something hard. I had nearly broken a toe on the stupid thing. As I had done before. I stood there for a moment, already feeling a chill in the September air. Something in the water shifted. A bubble. A ripple of water. Of light. Slowly, I bent at the waist and reached carefully into the river's depths. A little deeper, a little farther to the left. Although I couldn't see it, my fingers closed around something hard. I took a firm grip and lifted it towards the surface. As the object came up towards me through the water, it became visible. It was eerie, hard, transparent, invisible in the water, becoming visible as it came into the air. A sudden sinking feeling told me that my heart already knew what the thing was before my head did, and both had already begun to pound as I realized that the object I was holding in my streaming hands was Fenella's crystal ball. The ball with which some unknown person had bashed in her skull. The ball with which someone had tried to kill her. The thing had been lying on the river bottom for days, its transparency making it invisible in the water, even though it was in plain sight. No wonder the police had missed it. Only if they had waded around in the shallows, and only then if they had stepped upon it by accident, as I had, would they have found the object of their search. I would, of course, take it to Inspector Hewitt at once. As I climbed the bank, I noticed that a silence had fallen upon the parlings, as if the birds were afraid to make even a peep. The crystal ball was cold in my hands, refracting distorted images of earth, trees and sky, its swirling colours like dye dropped into water. If it hadn't been for the glass, I might have missed the flash of blue among the trees, a colour that didn't belong there. I stopped in my tracks as if preoccupied. "Don't look directly at it," I thought. I twisted the hem of my dress